Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast lifting the language barrier to show you the world through its media.
Радіо Тегеран.
Ми не вторгались на територію України.
Western countries are not the international community. That era has finished.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for the explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 10th of April, these are our main stories. Nearly 100,000 people have been forced from their homes in Kazakhstan by what's been described as the worst flooding in almost a century. A significant meeting has taken place between Taiwan and China. President Xi has hosted the former leader of Taiwan in the first such meeting in Beijing since the founding of Communist China. Also in this podcast, they say it's the taking part that counts, but now some Olympic gold medalists in Paris will get prize money as well as medals. We're going to tell you what to do when you're angry. And
那我怎么可能会说中文呢? Et si je pouvais parler couramment le français? Chciałbym umieć mówić po polsku.
How we can all speak in any language in our own voice, thanks to AI. We start in Kazakhstan, where more towns and cities across the country and in southern Russia are being evacuated following the worst flooding in the region in decades. Tens of thousands of people have been forced from their homes due to melting snow caused by unseasonably warm temperatures. The Russian authorities are facing criticism over their response in some of the worst hit areas. In the city of Orsk, protesters gathered, shouting, "Shame!" The Russian presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov warned the situation was likely to get worse.
So far, the forecast is not favourable. The water level continues to rise. A large amount of water is reaching new regions, Kurgan, Tumen. So the situation is very tense, which of course requires the most energetic efforts from government officials at all levels to help the people.
I asked Oleg Bolyarev of BBC Russian what's happening on the Russian side of the border.
We're now getting reports from Orenburg, the capital of Orenburg region in the southern Urals. People there are preparing to be evacuated. The waters of the Ural River, which caused so much trouble upstream, have passed the official critical mark of 930 centimeters. The news from there are not as bad as from Orsk, which lays a few dozen kilometers upstream. There in Orsk, 7,000 homes have been filled with water to the brim, and the consequences are truly catastrophic.
And there's more reporting from the Russian side than the Kazakh side of the mountains, where the emergencies ministry have announced that 100,000 people have been evacuated.
Yes, inevitably, Ural River will carry its waters a few dozen more kilometers and then across the border into Kazakhstan. Authorities there seem to be more prepared. I must confess, the first warnings of dangerous flood situation, which I heard, were coming from Kazakhstan, not from Russia. So I assume the river flows in a different direction. But yes, as you said, up to 100,000 people, that indicates more preparedness because there's more people being evacuated. Certainly the biggest criticism towards Russian authorities in Orsk is that there's been such an insufficient warning.
You were telling me yesterday that the flood waters had peaked, but then there's still plenty of snow up there to melt.
Yes, there is a large hydroelectric dam upstream, and it's regulating the flow to some extent, but obviously needs to dump some water. And it seems to be a miscoordination between authorities where a large amount of water started to be dumped. Somebody should have told the people of Orsk to be prepared. Orsk has seen catastrophic floods before. The one in 1957, people say, was just as bad as this one. So they've built this dam made of earth and were hoping that this will contain the water. But as early as the 4th or the 5th of April, it was evident that the water is starting to destroy that embankment. And even then, the authorities were saying that things are in order, which they obviously weren't.
And you've got people in Russia protesting about the government response, asking for Vladimir Putin to do more. Some people want him to come to the region. Do you think he will?
I don't think he will. Vladimir Putin does not like to appear in active disaster zones. It goes way back to the events of Kursk submarine, which drowned in the Barents Sea. And Mr. Putin learned the hard way, speaking to the furious relatives of those sailors who drowned. So he might come to this region, but only after events stabilize and he would be able to present himself as a man in control and against the backdrop of things being done. It will take many, many weeks and months for the consequences to be repaired. Right now, people are waiting for the water to leave their houses. This will happen in a few days. And when they come back, obviously, they will find all their possessions destroyed.
Oleg Boldyrev from BBC Russian. 6 months into the Israel-Gaza war, the US is hardening its stance against the way Israel is conducting itself. In his strongest words yet, President Biden said he thought Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's approach was wrong. The comments mark a significant shift from his previous position that it was up to Hamas to agree to a truce and release Israeli hostages.
I think what he's doing is a mistake. I think it's outrageous that those three vehicles were hit by drones on a highway where it wasn't like it was along the shore. It wasn't like there was a convoy moving here, et cetera. So what I'm calling for is for the Israelis to just call for a ceasefire, allow for the next 6-8 weeks total access to all food and medicine going into the country.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Hugo Beshega, assesses President Biden's remarks.
These are the strongest comments yet by President Biden, who has offered unconditional support for the Israelis in this war. We know that there is now a proposal that's being made after the latest round of mediator talks in Cairo. Now, at the center of this proposal is the idea of 40 hostages being freed, hostages who are being held in Gaza. In return, 900 Palestinians would be released from Israeli jails, and then there would be a six-week pausing hostilities in Gaza. So we don't know whether major obstacles have been resolved, but Hamas says it is now analysing the situation.
Our international editor Jeremy Bowen has been to Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, just 40 kilometres or so from Gaza, to get the views of three students who spent months fighting in combat units in Gaza. They're just some of the tens of thousands of Israeli reservists who were mobilised after the attacks by Hamas on the 7th of October.
My name is Oded Adler, and I've been now in Gaza for about 4 months, and I'm studying here, business management, third year.
My name is Ilan. In the reserves, I was mostly in Gaza and all of the areas, the north, the center, the south, and I study here physiotherapy, second year.
Hi, my name is Ben. I'm a master's student here in BGU for physics. I am in the engineering unit in the 98th division.
So, Ben, you were in Gaza till last Friday. What was it like? What were you guys doing?
Well, it was dangerous at times, but it doesn't really cross your head. You're in your mission, you're in what you're doing, you're kind of tunnel visioned in. The whole time that I was there, I would remember October 7th, I remember all my friends, and some are still hostages. So I was thinking of him, trying to remember like why we're there, to make sure that it can never happen again.
Do you all have friends who have been caught up in it, who became victims, who were ended up as hostages?
I think if you'll go around this campus and you'll ask each one, does he know someone that's killed in the 7th of October, that was kidnapped? It's everywhere. Yes, it's personal.
When you were in Gaza, did you see Palestinian civilians?
Yes.
A lot of them, they've gone through hell.
For sure. Yeah.
But Deb, what do you think about this? I mean, what did you think about that as a human being?
I think war is terrible. And to see civilians that are getting killed, evacuate from their homes because the army needs to get in, it's not something that makes me happy to see. Like every time we went to a new area in Gaza, so the army went with airplanes and put a lot of papers that said the army is going to get in. As a soldier, you think, well, okay, now I'm telling the enemy I'm coming to a new area. That's not smart. But as a human being, I understand it's crucial. But I think and I hope, and this is what we have here, hope, that once Hamas will be finished, so also the Palestinians in Gaza will have much better life. And you know what? A lot of the time, even the Palestinians told us that it's good that Hamas won't be there anymore.
Ilan, a lot of people around the world had massive sympathy with Israel on the 7th of October. And of course, they still sympathize with what's happened. But then they look at what's happened ever since. Even the Americans are saying, you're not fighting the right way. You're killing too many civilians. You're breaking too much infrastructure. I mean, what would your response be to that?
In this case, Hamas, that it's more than a terror group. It's kind of an army. And they fight a different kind of tactic. Like, they hide behind civilians. They sit inside their tunnels. They go out for like 10 seconds, shoot, go back. And then I think it's really hard to tell us how to fight.
Ben, what's your view on that?
We were under like sniper fire, and a unit nearby us knew how to help us, but they couldn't do it yet because we had suspicion that there were civilians there. Like, how can you say that we're not doing enough to save Gazan civilians when I'm practically putting my life on the line for this? For the same people that just several months ago tried to slaughter my friends and my families.
Joe Biden says this has got to lead to a Palestinian state. That is the recipe for peace. Do you agree with that?
I think that if you'd have asked me this question on October 6th, then I would say definitely yes. But after October 7th, it seems clear to me that they don't want it as much as I wanted it.
Some people say that going in like this does not actually make Israel safer longer term, because all those young boys who are watching all of this will, when they get to be 17 or 18, they want to pick up a gun and maybe kill an Israeli and get some revenge. Do you think it might radicalize people? Do you think that's a danger?
I think you could ask Gazans the same question. Like, we've been radicalized. It's a two-way street, sort of. I mean, it feels kind of Israel's responsibility to not radicalize Gazans, but where's Gazans' responsibility towards us? If we ever want to coexist, if we want a two-state solution, we need responsibility on both sides.
That was Oded, Ilan and Ben with our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. Meanwhile, there have been more international moves towards recognising a Palestinian state. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, speaking to Parliament, has said Spain, along with three other EU countries, is ready to declare such a recognition, calling it a step towards resolving the conflict in the Middle East. But he gave no date. Separately, Australia's Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, has said peace and stability will come to Israel only through international recognition of a Palestinian state. Now, they say it's the taking part that counts, but the winners of athletics events at this year's Olympics won't just be taking home a gold medal. World Athletics has announced it'll become the first international federation to award prize money at an Olympics, starting in Paris this summer. A good idea, according to former Olympic athlete and 1500-metre silver medalist Steve Cram.
You know, World Athletics receives money from the IOC, as do all of the federations, from the profits, if you like, from the games. And that money over the years, certainly back in my day, I had no idea where that money went. Why shouldn't a percentage come back to the athletes? So I don't really have a problem with it.
Our correspondent Matt Graveling told me more about the decision.
This is across athletics. So I think track and field, I mean, everyone's kind of highlight of the games really is the 100-metre final, isn't it? This would fall into that. But it's also things like the javelin, the discus. And World Athletics, who are the governing body that look after all of track and field, not just at the Olympics, but across all events, they've ring-fenced $2.4 million. Now, this is money that they get from the International Olympics Committee, and they in turn get their money from broadcast revenue. So it trickles down through the federations, and World Athletics said, right, we're going to give a little bit more of this money that we get back to the athletes. It's the first time that they've financially incentivized the winning of a gold medal. So in Paris, which is just 107 days away, if you do win a gold medal in athletics, you will get that $50,000. And that is also going to be extended with a commitment from World Athletics to Los Angeles in 2028, where they say they're also going to reward the silver and the bronze place medalists, although they haven't given us an idea on amounts for that yet.
If you're serious about track and field events, then the idea of representing your country at the Olympics is the pinnacle of what you can achieve. Why do you also need some cash?
I think that's right. And I was lucky enough to be on a meeting this morning with Lord Coe, who is, of course, the president of World Athletics and a two-time gold medalist himself, Andrew. In the 80s, he won gold twice, didn't he, in two consecutive games in the 1500. If he'd been competing for this kind of money, he would have walked away with $100,000. But I think it's important to say that for most athletes, Lord Coe says, that will be enough. It will be the pinnacle of their success. He doesn't believe this financial incentive will ruin the spirit of the games. However, a lot of athletes are getting a lot of money through sponsorship. If you look at Usain Bolt, he won 8 gold medals at the Olympics. 2 of them were in the relay. That prize money would be split between all 4 people. But he would have effectively got $350,000. Now, Does he need that with all the endorsements that he had? Possibly not over that whole career. But if you look at people like javelin throwers and discus and shot put, the money for those kind of athletes who a lot do have to self-fund could be invaluable.
And this is going to put a lot of pressure on the governing bodies of other Olympic sports to follow suit, do the same thing.
That also came up in the meeting with Lord Coe earlier. You've gone first on this. And while money back to the athletes can't be seen as a bad thing, is it going to look bad on other federations who now aren't paying their athletes similar money? And Lord Coe says, look, we can only do what we can do. We feel this is right. We want to financially reward the athletes who effectively are the reason why the broadcast money comes in anyway, because they're the stars of the show.
Our correspondent, Matt Graveling. Boeing is in trouble again. It's already under investigation after an exit door broke off one of its 787 MAX 9 planes in January, prompting the chief executive, David Calhoun, to announce his resignation. And on Monday, an engine cover broke off during a flight. Now an engineer has accused the company of taking shortcuts during the construction of its 787 and 777 planes. The claims by Sam Salapour sparked an investigation by the US Federal Aviation Authority. That and the fact that Boeing only delivered 83 planes in the first quarter of 2024 put the markets in a spin, wiping almost 2% off the company's share price. Boeing dismissed the allegations as inaccurate, saying it was confident its planes were safe. Here's our business correspondent, Erin Delmore.
A former Boeing employee accused the company of cutting corners and overlooking engineering problems during production of the 787 Dreamliner that he said could weaken the plane's structural integrity. Boeing dismissed the claims as inaccurate and reiterated confidence in the model. Now the Federal Aviation Administration is investigating the whistleblower's accusations, and Congress plans to question him this month. Meanwhile, the company delivered its lowest number of planes in the first quarter of the year since 2021, just 83 planes, down from 157 the quarter prior. Boeing executives say the company is slowing down production so that it can improve quality control. The U.S.'s top aviation watchdog is enforcing that process. But delivery delays are sparking criticism from customers who have little choice to fulfill their needs. Boeing and Airbus dominate the U.S. market. The company's shares dropped Tuesday to their lowest in 5 months.
Erin Delmore reporting. And still to come.
I mean, we're in the year 2024. This is going back in time to a time when people didn't have bodily autonomy.
We hear from the head of the biggest abortion clinic in Arizona after the U.S. state's Supreme Court ruled in favor of an abortion ban. Now, there's no love lost between China and Taiwan. For decades, China has insisted the self-ruled island of Taiwan is a breakaway province. And President Xi Jinping has made no secret that he wants to eventually take it back under Beijing's control. So the fact that President Xi has held talks with Taiwan's former president, Ma Ying-jeou, is significant. And he sounded positive.
Compatriots on both sides of the Taiwan Strait are Chinese. There is no rancor that cannot be resolved. There are no issues that cannot be discussed. No force can separate us. Differences in our systems cannot change the objective fact that both sides of the Taiwan Strait belong to the same nation, the same ethnicity. Foreign interference cannot stop the historic event of a family reunion.
To find out more about the meeting, I spoke to our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
Normally, Andrew, we wouldn't really bother spending time talking about a meeting between China's current leader and a former leader, Ma Ying-jeou, who was Taiwan's president. He voted out of office in 2016, so he doesn't really have much political power now. But this meeting was treated by the leaders in Beijing as if it was quite important. If you look at the video of it, it's in quite an ornate stateroom. As we just heard, Xi Jinping said very, very warm things. And it was almost like China was trying to show the people of Taiwan an alternate reality, the future they could choose if only they agreed that Taiwan was part of China. And they went back in time to the years that Ma Ying-jeou was actually in power, when he had much, much closer ties with China, when there were direct flights between the two, when there was a lot of trade between the two. And so it was almost like China was trying to remind people in Taiwan what they could have if only they accepted Xi Jinping's conditions.
Meanwhile, the newly elected president's about to be sworn in and couldn't have a more different approach.
That's right. So the newly elected president is William Lai from the DPP. That's the arch rival to Ma Ying-jeou's party, the KMT. And William Lai has a much different approach. He has said that he's open to dialogue with China, something the Chinese leaders have never wanted to endorse. But he says that really he's a defender of democracy. He says that he doesn't need Taiwan to ever actually declare independence because it already is independent, he says. And so he's advocated a path that really takes Taiwan towards much, much closer relationships with the United States and other Western allies like the EU. We have to put this in context. This is all taking under, this is all happening, this meeting in Beijing today, while Beijing is putting a lot of pressure on Taiwan. Militarily, we're seeing a lot of Chinese planes and ships going near Taiwan almost every day. And diplomatically, Taiwan's being isolated. You know, there's only 11 countries and the Vatican now formally recognize Taiwan as a political entity.
Our Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. In the previous podcast, we told you about Arizona, the 15th U.S. state to bring in a near total abortion ban since the nationwide right to a termination was removed 2 years ago. That law is expected to come into effect in 2 weeks. We got reaction from the owner and director of the Camelback Family Planning Clinic in Arizona, Dr. Gabriella Goodrick, who's been helping women access abortion services for nearly 3 decades. She spoke to my colleague, Victoria Uwanhunda.
My reaction has been shock, dismay, really disgust. I mean, it's the law is draconian. It's cruel. We're in the year 2024. This is going back in time to a time when people didn't have bodily autonomy.
So who's going to be most at risk with this law?
This law, if it succeeds in becoming truly law, will ban abortion except for the life of the person who's pregnant. So it's very extreme. There's no exceptions for rape or incest or fatal fetal abnormalities. It doesn't take into account any suffering, you know, on the part of the woman with medical conditions. It affects many people, people that don't think it will affect them, people that have wanted pregnancies, who develop complications, who can't get the care they need in the state they live and have to travel. But of course, these bans affect marginalized populations the most. Black and brown women, Latina women, poor rural women, young people, it affects them the most because they won't have the resources to travel to get the care that they need.
For many years, you've been working at clinics and helping women have access to abortion services. I wonder, what are some of the cases that you've come across of women who've come to you or the women that you've worked with?
Every patient I see has a compelling reason to end their pregnancy. Every single patient. Most people have multiple reasons for seeking this care. One out of four women will have an abortion in their lifetime. This is not an uncommon experience. Pregnancy complications happen, and abortion care will always be needed. And women come for, like I said, many reasons: abusive relationships, they're not emotionally, physically, or financially ready to add a child to their family or become a parent. They are ill. They are 50 years old. They are 12 years old. They have been sexually assaulted. They have cancer. What else? I mean, I could go on and on. You know, it's a personal decision that a person has to make with their family and their doctor.
So what's going to happen then to clinics in Arizona that offer abortion services?
I think that we will survive because this extreme law will push Arizonans to vote and to vote pro-choice, to support a referendum that is going to be on the ballot in November that will put it in our Constitution that all people of Arizona have reproductive freedom and bodily autonomy. And this will swing the other way. And we will have abortion in Arizona as a part of health care that people need here, just like they need all over the world.
Dr. Gabriella Goodrick in Arizona. Votes are being counted in South Korea's election. It looks like opposition parties may have increased their majority. And if the exit polls are right, that'll be a setback for the South Korean president. Our correspondent in Seoul is Jean McKenzie.
The first thing to note is that exit polls in Korea are unreliable. They have been wrong in the past, and they don't take account of the early voting that's been happening here over the past week. And so we don't want to read too much into them. If they are correct, though, it means that the Liberal Opposition Party is on course to win a significant majority in the parliament. These elections, although just parliamentary elections, they don't decide the president. They are being seen as a midterm referendum on the current president, Yoon Suk-yeol, who's been in office for 2 years now. Now, he has been unpopular from the start, but neither side expected him to be punished this much. If his party does lose in a big way, it will weaken his authority and make it nearly impossible for him to be able to push ahead with his agenda and pass legislation. The big number that everybody is interested in is 200. This is what's needed to get what's called a supermajority here. And it means that if the opposition party and the smaller parties get 200 seats or more between them, they can join forces to push through laws the government doesn't want. The president will no longer be able to use his veto. And that could make politics here pretty chaotic. But we will have to wait until the morning here in Korea to find out the results for real and what they mean. But they could have big implications for how this country's run over the next 3 years.
Jean McKenzie in Seoul. If learning a language was easy, we'd all be multilingual, I guess. Of course, it's not that straightforward. But now, thanks to AI, conversing in a different language is something anyone can do. James Clayton reports.
Unfortunately, I can't speak any other languages fluently other than English. 那我怎么可能会说中文呢? 如果我能够流利地说法语, et si je pouvais parler couramment le français, comment cela serait-il possible? What if I could speak Polish? Chciałbym umieć mówić po polsku.
Thanks to new AI apps, though, I can give at least the impression of being able to speak pretty much any language. This one is called HeyGen.
So I'm going to speak like this. I'm
just I do a quick video of myself, upload it onto HeyGen and wait. And then out pops a video of me speaking the language that I chose, in this case, Spanish.
Sí, así que voy a hablar o así voy a decir aproximadamente lo que dije antes, así que...
And here's the really cool bit. When Omar, the producer on this piece, got into the shot, it detected his voice was different to mine and translated his voice too.
You are in shot, my friend.
Estoy en el tiro, pero voy a salir del tiro en breve.
I've actually managed to fool some friends using this. It really is impressive. In London, one company called Synthesia is using this kind of tech to translate AI-generated corporate videos into any language.
Many of these companies, of course, have divisions all over the world whom they need to, it's a sales force maybe that they need to train, right? And with this tool, they can create the base material in English. They can then translate it into different localities.
But the company's founder says the tech has other benefits too.
And we're seeing that with like NGOs all over the world, where they can produce video content instead of written content for people who may have a difficult time reading and can do it in local languages. So in just this kind of dissemination of information in people's native language via video and audio is very, very powerful. Ground control
law. As it gets easier and easier to change the words that come out of our mouths, there's also a worry that this kind of technology could increase the amount of misinformation on the internet.
I still believe...
But when it comes to translating educational videos or sending a message to someone in their own language, gibt es klare Vorteile. Es geht nicht nur darum, Freunde beeindrucken zu wollen.
James Clayton telling us, with a little help from AI in German, that there's more to this technology than just impressing your friends. Now, before we go, is there anything you want to get off your chest? A study from Nagoya University in Japan reveals the best way of managing anger might be to scribble down your thoughts and then throw them away. Jacob Perkins has more.
You might think that keeping your thoughts locked away is a good way to deal with them. But the act of writing them down, scrunching them up and putting them in the bin could change your perspective. That's according to a study where researchers asked participants to write down opinions about social issues and were told that someone would evaluate their writing. But there wasn't really an evaluation, and they were given low scores on things like their intelligence and their logic. The participants then had to write down their reaction to the comments and focus on what triggered their emotions. Half were told to scrunch up their paper and throw it in the bin, or put it in a shredder. The others were told to put it in a box or keep it in a file. All were highly angry after being insulted, but the anger levels dropped for individuals who got rid of their paper. The lead researcher, Nobuyuki Kawai, said he expected it would suppress anger to some extent, but it was actually eliminated almost entirely. He said the method echoes a centuries-old Japanese tradition, where angry feelings are set down in writing, sealed in a small vessel, and then destroyed. And he says it's important for businesses too.
Anger sometimes destroys the human relationship, for friendship or couple or even in companies. I think we can use our method to keep our relationship better.
So next time you want to shout at someone, maybe just write down your thoughts and give this method a go.
Jacob Perkins reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you'll find us on X, where we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer was Marion Strawn. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye. Thank you.